Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, filling in for John Stattmiller on the Intel Report on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Scott Horton. I do the weekend interview show here on Republic every Saturday from 3 to 5 Texas time. That's Central. And I've been doing the show for about a year now. I'm glad that Stattmiller's got me in here subbing for him. Proud to do it. And got a great show lined up for you today. I got plenty of news and got a very interesting guest for the first hour. Well, in fact, before I get to the interview, I want to read this quote to you very quickly here. This is a quote from Dr. Gordon Prather. He's a friend of mine. He writes for antiwar.com. He was involved with nuclear weapons research and construction and demolition and detonation and everything else for the U.S. Navy, the Sandia and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. He was the chief scientist of the U.S. Army, an advisor to U.S. senators. He's completely versed in all of the treaties regarding weapons proliferation, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, etc. And I have here a quote from Dr. Gordon Prather regarding Iran. As a result of 2 years of go-anywhere, see-anything inspections, as best the IAEA can determine, Iran does not now have, never has had, and doesn't have plans to develop in the future even the capability of producing the weapons-grade enriched uranium or plutonium absolutely essential to making even one nuclear weapon. That is the quote from Dr. Prather, who is probably ranking in the top probably five people in America qualified to state such things. So take that for what it's worth. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Philip Giraldi. He's a former intelligence officer in the military and a former CIA counterterrorism official. He now writes Deep Background for the American Conservative magazine and is co-publisher of Intelligence Brief with Vincent Canestrano. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yes, hello.
It's great to have you on here today. In the August 1st issue in your Deep Background brief is included a bit called, In Case of Emergency, Nuke Iran, where you say you've been in contact with some Air Force officers bearing some pretty bad news. What was it that they told you?
Well, basically, some officers in the Air Force are talking about a contingency plan that is being drawn up at the instructions of the White House, more specifically the Office of the Vice President. And the plan essentially is for a nuclear response against Iran if there is another major terrorist incident in the United States, something along the lines of 9/11.
Well, but the military has plans to invade Canada and Mexico and pretty much everybody all the time, right? So just because they're drawing up a plan doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to use it, does it?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but the fact is that it's basically this is something that's coming out of the same people that brought us Iraq and brought us the military response against Iraq when Iraq was not involved with the terrorist incident. So the scary thing about this, the Dr. Strangelove aspect of it, is that the thinking that's going down here is basically that you would use the opportunity of a terrorist attack to take out Iran as basically a threat in that region.
Right, and that's really well said, take the opportunity, because at best my knowledge, and perhaps you could correct me if I'm wrong, Iran has nothing to do with al-Qaeda. Iran is run by Shiite mullahs, not by Salafists, Wahhabi Sunnis.
Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. There have long been allegations that the Iranian government, particularly the Revolutionary Guards, have been sheltering some al-Qaeda, but basically in a situation to use them. And there's definitely a clear antipathy between al-Qaeda and Iran, and there's no reason to assume that there would be any connection between the two.
Okay, hold it right there, everybody. We'll be right back with Philip Giraldi on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
You're listening to the National Intel Report with your host, John Stattmiller.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton, filling in for John Stattmiller. He's still recuperating from his motorcycle wreck. And I'm talking with Philip Giraldi, He's a former CIA counterterrorism official, now writes Deep Background for the American Conservative magazine. And, sir, you were saying before the break that this was particularly worrying as opposed to just the average military plan that's drawn up and put on the shelf, because this is coming from the same people as the military response against Iraq, or not even response, the military invasion of Iraq. And I wonder, you're referring to the vice president's office?
Yeah, particularly the vice president, but also the whole neocon clique. The neocons, has been very clear, are making no secret of the fact that Iran is next on the hit list. So, you put the one fact, the contingency plan, together with the other fact, and it seems to suggest that a terrorism incident would definitely be used as an excuse to unleash an attack against Iran, and an attack that might conceivably use nuclear weapons.
And as I pointed out at the beginning of the show, nuclear weapons against hardened bunkers full of apparently nothing, because the IAEA has been there for 2 years, go anywhere, see anything, and has given Iran a clean bill of health.
Well, that's not exactly true. There are certain indications that Iran has been concealing elements in its program, and I think a lot of the European intelligence services and also the United States intelligence services believe that Iran has a program of some kind. The motivating factor for their program is the American presence in the region. The fact that they and the North Koreans have both learned that if you want to keep the Americans off your back, the only way to do it is to get your own nuclear weapons.
Well, I don't know, because in talking to Gordon Prater, he says, look, they'd have to have gigantic cascades of centrifuges working overtime in order to produce the hexafluoride gas that they would need, and that there's no indication whatsoever that they have any of that.
Well, that would be, of course, suggesting that you have a program that's from scratch. And, of course, there has been intelligence suggesting that they have obtained stuff that's already in the developmental process from places like Pakistan.
Oh, I see. Okay, so, well, and then it's still, as you said, that's still sort of besides the point, because it's the American presence in the region that is their motivating factor for attempting to arm themselves, if, in fact, they are.
That's right. And I think everybody, even those who have probably a worst-case scenario when they think of Iran, would agree that Iran is years and years away from any kind of effective program.
Now, Scott Ritter wrote an article a few months back that said that I believe it was Air Force leaks to him, too, that they were working on plans that they were supposed to be ready by June. Is that the same group of people, or is that something else?
No, I think we're talking about two separate groups of plans. The plan that I reported on last week is basically the strategic command. So you're talking about heavy bombers and that sort of thing, our strategic capabilities, including nuclear weapons. The plan that Scott Ritter wrote about, and I did read that article, is a more tactical response. In other words, using the resources we have on the ground already in the Middle East to attack Iran's known facilities where it's suspected there might be some of these nuclear development programs going on. It's not the bigger scenario that I wrote about.
I see. Now, I personally have a little bit of hearsay coming my way that has Air Force intelligence already in Qatar picking targets in Iran right now.
There's no doubt about that. And there's also, I think there are also, there have been penetrations of Iran by special operations soldiers and also by Iranian dissidents who are being paid by the Pentagon to gather that type of information, too.
And you're referring to the Mujahideen al-Khalq there, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about them, who they are and how they're being used?
Well, they're a funny old group. I mean, they were a group of secular Iranians that were basically, some of them are communists, but they basically organized against the religious regime in Iran and were given shelter by Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein actually more or less turned them into a military brigade and armed them with heavy weapons and kind of kept them north of Baghdad as a threat against the Iranian government. These people are on the United States government official list as terrorists, and yet since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, they've been protected by the Pentagon. And there are a lot of indications that they are being used by the Pentagon as as a provocation, essentially, against Iran.
Wow, so there we have it. Saddam Hussein really was tied to terrorism, to the Mujahideen al-Khalq, who are now our allies against Iran.
That's right. And in fact, the Pentagon has been pushing lately to get them delisted off of the terrorism list so that it can use them more freely.
Oh, right, because it's the State Department's list, right?
Exactly.
A little interagency warfare going on there.
That's exactly right.
That's funny. And now, again, Scott Ritter wrote an article, I guess only a couple of weeks ago, or 2 or 3 weeks ago, saying that the Mujahideen al-Khalq has been in Iran setting off remote bombs and killing people, just like we complain about what's happening to our guys in Iraq.
Yeah, that may or may not be true. There certainly have been reports that there certainly were bombings in some of the southern, large majority Arab cities of Iran. And, the suspicion is that the bombers may well have been connected with MEK.
I see. Now, well, let's get into this whole, thing about the covert operations being turned over from the CIA really into the hands of the military. I know you were one of the sources for Seymour Hersh's January article in the New Yorker called The Coming Wars. That basically describes really the military's victory in an interagency fight between the CIA and the Pentagon over who's going to be running covert operations and the implications of that. They call it the El Salvador option, right?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that means what, basically recruiting locals to be your death squad for you?
Well, that's essentially it. It's there's a big difference between intelligence gathering and the type of operations that the military specializes in running. They're culturally different. They're mentally different. Their objectives should be different. The problem is that this whole confusing war on terrorism has tended to meld all these things together and given a hearing for people who kind of steer towards the violent option, and that tends to be the Pentagon at the moment.
So if you had been, national security advisor on September 11th, what would your advice have been? How should we have carried out this war if not in the way it's being carried out now?
Well, I think essentially the whole thing is wrong-headed. We're basically... First of all, to describe a war on terrorism is kind of oxymoronic in that terror is not a country, terror is not a place, and you can't really make a war on it. What you can do essentially is treat terrorism as a transnational and international issue that you go after using intelligence resources and you go after in a smart way. We've been doing it kind of with the bludgeon. It was right to go into Afghanistan because that was a base of organized terror. But as we can see, the terror problem has morphed and moved since that time and has, if anything, become stronger.
Sure, and we didn't really succeed in doing anything in Afghanistan except killing 10,000 innocent people.
Well, we basically, if we succeeded at anything, it was eliminating a conventional base for al-Qaeda, but al-Qaeda has demonstrated it doesn't need a conventional base. It has evolved into another form and is just as effective or more effective than it was.
Okay, now this gets really to the crux of the issue in the most basic terms, the way Dick Cheney puts it across on TV. He says, listen, the problem with the Clinton years was they kept treating us like police work, and what we have learned is you got to treat it like a war. Now, they don't want to get into all kinds of details, but that's basically, on its face, that's what we've learned is that this is a war, and we got to take it seriously. It is my assertion, and you tell me what your opinion is on this, but as I look at the history of the terrorist ring surrounding Sheikh Omar Abdel-Rahman and Ramzi Youssef, from 1993 all the way through 2001, I see barely any police work whatsoever except after the fact. It seems to me like the FBI were never in a position to do any police work to stop these guys. And then now that they've been successful in having this major attack on September 11th, well, now we've learned the lesson that police work was a mistake when they never even tried it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the problem was the FBI was not geared to use intelligence effectively against a terrorist type target in the United States. It probably still isn't. That's the sad truth of 4 years after 9/11. It was never really tried. I think the point is that the criticisms of the Clinton administration for the things it did and did not do are valid to a certain extent. there were opportunities of various types to behead the Al Qaeda organization, which were not taken. And but the fact is that it's convenient for Dick Cheney to claim that we're on a war footing now, because that kind of justifies anything that he and the administration want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Such as ran the Patriot Act through for the next 10 years.
Exactly.
Which, interestingly enough, according to Syracuse University, I'm sorry to diverge off on a tangent on the Patriot Act, but according to Syracuse University, they only use this Patriot Act against regular folks. It's been like 600, you know, plain old people, drug cases and casino money laundering and, you know, little stuff that has nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever is what they use it for.
Well, the Washington Post had a similar expose, and it said the same thing. It said there only been there've been less than 40 arrests that actually impute anything, any connection with terrorism, and all of those arrests basically were aiding and abetting, or perhaps telling someone's friend that hey, those terrorists aren't really bad guys, that of that nature. In fact, the Patriot Act has not led to the best of my knowledge, has not led to a single prosecution of an actual terrorist or terrorist supporter.
Right. Well, they got a couple convictions in Detroit, but then they had to let them all go because the FBI had perjured themselves on the stand.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. We'll be right back with Philip Giraldi from the American Conservative. Welcome back to the Intel Report. It's John Statmiller's show, but I'm Scott Horton filling in for him. And you can check out what I write at antiwar.com. I just got an email today asking me for permission for a news magazine in Malaysia to reprint my last article I wrote. How about that? That's pretty cool, huh? It was called Poisonous Misinterpretations about my interview with Robert A. Pape from the University of Chicago. But check that one out. It was a pretty good article. Compared to what I usually write. Also, weekendinterviewshow.com is my website. I keep all the archives there. And this is the Intel Report, and I'm talking with Philip Giraldi, and we're supposed to be talking about Iran, but I got the attention deficit thing going on here, so we've been skipping all around. But back to, first of all, Giraldi writes Deep Background for the American Conservative magazine, and it's a little news brief section, and the actual article we're discussing is not available online at the American Conservative, but if you go to justinlogan.com or go to antiwar.com and check the blog there, we have Justin Logan transcribed the whole piece for us there, so you can find it on the internet. And it's called In Case of Emergency, Nuke Iran. You know, like break glass, only murder people by the millions. And of course, the purpose supposedly of needing to use tactical nuclear weapons as opposed to just, you know, regular JDAMs or whatever they have, is to penetrate those deep underground bunkers. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be the reason. Obviously, they've done a lot of surveillance photography and everything on Iranian sites. They estimate there are hundreds of possible Iranian nuclear sites. A lot of them, obviously, if they exist, are deep underground, have been hardened to make them actually to protect them against an Israeli airstrike with the lighter armaments that the Israeli aircraft would be able to use. So nukes tend to be the tactical nukes would tend to be the option if you really want to take out the country's capability.
Now, are these sites buried, hidden back in the mountains somewhere, or are we talking about downtown Tehran?
Well, some of the sites are in the city, but a lot of them are in desert areas or rural areas in the mountains. Yes, indeed. Some of the sites that are believed to be the hardest to attack with conventional weapons are sites that would be in the desert and deep underground.
Well, okay, we can't really have a land invasion, right? Because then all the Shia in Iraq are going to turn on us, too. So are we talking about just bombing them from the air and then going home?
Yeah.
And what's that supposed to accomplish? I know Michael Ledeen has this theory that once we bomb them, all the people will overthrow their government and want to become our ally. But
he had that theory. He had that theory about Iraq too. Ledeen often overreaches himself. The reality of Iraq has demonstrated to our military that they can't wage a ground war against Iran, which is three times bigger geographically and three times more populous and also better armed. So the issue becomes, if you are going to exercise a military option, there has to be an air option. And as you say, it's kind of pointless. I mean, then what do? You go home.
Yeah, well, you just leave a bunch of dead people behind and all their relatives angry.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really want to help paper over the differences between the Shia and the Sunni in the Arab world, try pushing them together as our common enemy. They might just take us up on it.
Well, that's definitely what the policy is. I don't have to explain to you that the policy in that region has been insane right from 4 years ago. So it's no surprise that no one is envisioning the consequences of this downstream.
Are you certain that that's true? I'm reminded of an article by Josh Marshall in, I think it was the Washington Monthly, a couple of years ago, called Practice to Deceive. And it was about how the neocons have really made Iraq a disaster on purpose. They sent too few troops on purpose. They made the whole thing kind of a permanent morass so they'd have an excuse to stay there, and that would make it easier for them to spread their global democratic revolution through Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the rest of their enemies.
I think that's much too subtle. I think that the reality is that what I hear from the neocons, and I still do speak to a couple of them, is that they are blaming Rumsfeld and Bremer essentially for the failure in Iraq. It's a blame game at the moment, and I think that they genuinely wanted a great victory in Iraq, which would have terrorized all the other neighbors for the benefit of Israel.
So they really thought they were going to get a Hashemite king or someone that was going to come in and become friends with Israel and everything was going to be great like that? They really believed that?
I think they really believed that, and I think some of them still believe that, incredibly enough.
Yeah, well, you might point out to them that it's too late, that the president of Iraq just went to Iran to lay a wreath at the shrine of the Ayatollah last week. I mean,
they, you know, these people on a certain level are quite smart, and they're quite studious in terms of following events there, and they know all these things. But the fact is, they're able to spin it in a way that it makes it look like it's a tactical thing, and it doesn't really matter.
I see. Well, and speaking of tactics, there was something in Newsweek called "Wargaming the Mullahs" that basically said. Well, to sum up, basically, they had run their war games, and the brass apparently came to the neocons and said, forget it, pal. We're not going to war against Iran. And not just we're against it like we were the Iraq war, but we're telling you no, because it would escalate. Not just can we not do it with ground troops, but that if we do start bombing Iran, then talk about domino theory. You're going to have all kinds of chaos and unintended consequences throughout South Asia. We could find ourselves in a war with Russia. For example, we bomb Bushehr is full of Russian scientists working on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, some of the neocons clearly would like some of them already speak of a World War III or a World War IV, depending on how far ahead you look. And they definitely would like to see a clash of civilizations in which the United States basically is going to take down the entire Islamic world.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back with Philip Giraldi from the American Conservative Magazine.
You're tuned in to the National Intel Report, the real talk radio show.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton, host of the Weekend Interview Show here on Republic, filling in for John Statmiller on the Intel Report. My website is Weekend Interview Show, and also I write for antiwar.com. I'm talking with Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism official. He now writes Deep Background for the American Conservative Magazine and is co-publisher of Intelligence Brief with Vincent Canestrano. And before the break, sir, you were talking about this clash of civilizations that the neoconservatives seem intent on having. Do you think that it is unavoidable at this point? Are we too far along into the terror war to call it off?
Well, two separate issues there. I think that the clash of civilizations is not inevitable because there is a large mass of people in both communities, if you want to speak of Christianity and Islam, that are not interested in going that route. But as far as the war on terror, I'm afraid the war on terror has taken on a life of its own. It's something that's basically been picked up and co-opted by both Democrats and Republicans and popularized by the press, even though it is basically a fiction. And unfortunately, this is something that is not going to go away.
Well, Michael Scheuer, in his book Imperial Hubris, the former head of the CIA's former head analyst at the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Alex Station. Robert Pape, in his new book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. The Royal Institute for International Affairs, the center of the Anglo foreign policy establishment. The Saudis and the Israelis, the Central Intelligence Agencies, the National Intelligence Council, and now even former Prime Minister John Major of Great Britain have all come out and said Iraq has made matters worse.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. In fact, I wrote an article for the American Conservative back, I think it was over 2 years ago, called Jihadi War, which predicted precisely that Iraq would serve as a magnet for jihadi warriors and would indeed make things worse.
Right, and you did write that just after the war in Iraq had begun.
Right.
And in fact, you say in that article that and this is really kind of cuts right to the point about, you talk about the fiction of the war on terror. We're sort of dealing with a fiction in the form of Al-Qaeda, too. I mean, at this point, as you point out in your article, there's so many of these attacks that are attributed to Al-Qaeda that are really done by homegrown locals who, perhaps are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda or whatever. But basically, these are just people that have been radicalized only lately and are doing things on their own. They don't have a leader. There's these tiny little cellular structures all separated from each other and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, that's basically true. Many of these groups might be getting direction from Al-Qaeda, but they're no longer dependent upon it for logistics. And that's a key issue, because you probably know that the basic way an intelligence service or a counterintelligence service works against a terrorist target is to identify its money trails and its how it gets equipment and how it gets recruits and that sort of thing. And when you decentralize that, it becomes essentially that much more difficult to attack the target.
So at this point, now that it's gone this far, say they made you the National Security Advisor today, how are you going to handle it? Would it be different than the way you would have handled it if you'd been in charge after September 11th?
Well, I think I would be seeing it in basically the same terms, that this is an intelligence problem more so than it is a military problem. And as an intelligence problem, you work against these targets in ways which are somewhat less sledgehammer than using military force. You use military force when you have to, or when there is a target that enables you to do that, but that's very rare. And so I would ramp this whole thing down. I would try to lower the level of fear that's being generated. Terrorism is not going to overthrow the United States. And I think we have to reduce it to its proper dimensions, which is an intelligence problem, and essentially, I hate even to use the expression because it's been so vilified, a law enforcement problem.
Well, but even you just said that intelligence is basically at this point impotent to stop this, because they're these separate little cells. They're not all connected. You can't trace all their money back to the source and that kind of thing.
Well, that's not really true. What I said was the problem is much more difficult now.
Okay.
You can penetrate a terrorist organization just as you can penetrate any other organization, but you have to basically make the commitment to do what you have to do in terms of structural terms to go after the target. And what specifically I'm saying here is that the CIA, even now, 4 years after 9/11, is not structured very effectively to go after terrorists, because there are mechanical impediments in place. Basically, very few CIA case officers are linguistically or culturally capable of going after the target. You have to change that.
Do you also recommend withdrawing forces from the Arabian Peninsula and kind of head at the root cause of why these people are so angry in the first place?
Well, the root cause that I would address immediately, because it is within the power of the United States to address it, is the Israel-Palestine issue. The whole issue of U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf is a much more complicated question, because we do have a vital strategic interest in the oil reserves that are in that area. But what I would like to see is a candid discussion of what our interests in the area are, what our equities are, and what the downside of maintaining a presence in the area is. We haven't seen any of that.
Right. It's sort of really outside of the discussion. I remember when Michael Schreuer came out with his book, he said basically the way he laid it out was you have two choices between war and total war, and that if we don't stop the policies that, or at least take a serious look at the policies that are motivating all these people, that we're going to end up having to kill all of them. And he wasn't trying to advocate that, and yet the spin on the Sunday morning news shows was, well, it ain't like we're going to abandon Israel, so obviously we're just going to have to do like he said and just wipe them out. And they're basically trying to take his whole argument and turn it around.
Exactly, and I'm saying I think basically the same thing. Michael Schreuer was essentially saying that, look, guys, it's policy that has created these issues, and the policy should be openly debated in front of the American public, and not just kind of brushed away and disguised as a war against terror.
What do you think about taking a couple of phone calls?
Sure.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism official. He now writes deep background for Pat Buchanan and Scott McConnell's magazine, The American Conservative. Let's go ahead and talk to John in New York. John?
Hi. I got a couple of things that I got some, I guess, some lowdown or whatever you want to call it. I don't understand that the Iranians had a magnet, an electromagnet bomb they were going to put over the U.S. and draw the juice out of us, and that was quite a, one bomb was going to do it. It wasn't going to have to be two or three. And do you know anything about that?
I've never heard that particular story. It's there are always a lot of allegations about advanced technologies that some of these countries may have developed that are going to be used against us. But I think when you track down through the story, you find out that most of it turns out to be untrue or something that just appeared in a blog somewhere and was kind of made up.
Okay. Also, in New York here, I set up one of the shows we have in the area in Syracuse. I set up a booth of 9/11 fraud and all that kind of thing. And I had one gentleman approach me from the military, and he says, we knocked out the Iraqi National Guard, 20,000 people in 3 minutes. He said, when I got to the site, it was solid glass. I haven't been able to have anybody verify that for me, but I know he used DU over there. But I didn't know if anybody knew there was like a 10-mile area over there. It's all solid melted sand, you know.
Implying that we use tactical nuclear weapons or something.
Yes.
Yeah, I had heard that story too, but I don't know anybody who's actually seen it.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks very much, John.
Thank you very much.
And let's talk to Roger in Pennsylvania. Roger?
Yeah, thanks. Just a quick question. While I'm sure you can find the 2 out of 10 of neocon policy elites that are living in some rarefied air, otherwise, is really anybody that stupid? I mean, even a knucklehead like me, aided with the likes of the Republic Network, etc., predicted with considerable accuracy 2 years ago the situation would be in Iraq today. In fact, it looks a little better than we might have predicted, just a tiny bit. But it's kind of like the plausibility quotient of could they really be that stupid is of the same level with what was floated a few months back, that somehow no one in the Pentagon anticipated the insurgency, as though somehow now all of a sudden you have an occupying power, but insurgencies no longer exist, that is, patriots within their country.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. The thing is, I was very much engaged with the lead-up before we invaded Iraq, and lots of people in the intelligence community, mostly retirees, obviously, were predicting just how bad it would be, as were a lot of State Department people and Department of Defense people who were retired.
No,
so there were a lot of voices, but the problem was nobody was listening, and the press did not do its job to give this side of the picture, that this war in Iraq was going to be a disaster, which in fact it's turned out to be.
Right, and really, you know, for those of us who were paying attention and reading the news, the leaks were there. As you say, the State Department and the CIA and retired military guys and people like Shinseki, who was very soon retired, they had things to say, but it was really this group of ex-Trotskyite types in the Pentagon and Doug Feith's office who were the ones who came up with all these talking points that the media
aided by Judith Miller. Let's not forget about her.
Oh, but isn't she a patron saint of free speech now?
Yes, she is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, right. You're right. She is the lady who lied us into war, isn't she?
Exactly.
And that's a funny little thing, that Judith Miller. And I know you've written a little bit about this, but I haven't read it because I admit I don't have a subscription to The American Conservative. But I have seen that somewhere you've written quite a bit of background about the Larry Franklin espionage scandal, which to me is the very same thing as the Chalabi scandal, the Who Forged the Niger Documents scandal, the Valerie Plame scandal. It's really all one big question of how loyal to Israel the neocons in the Pentagon really were, isn't it?
Well, I would think it's actually the answer to that is quite clear. It's the same players that emerge in all these scandals that emerge in all these cases. And if you look back in the biographies of Richard Perle, of Douglas Feith, of Paul Wolfowitz, you will see the same, shall we say, extreme loyalty to Israel, and not only to Israel, to the Likud version of Israel. There's no question. I mean, some of these people had their security clearances lifted because of suspicious relationships with Israel, but now suddenly they're back in the Pentagon. They all have their clearances back.
Do you think that Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman are going to be indicted?
I think so, but I think the ultimate question here is to what extent the White House puts political pressure to cool it and to maybe minimize it because of the Israeli the potential impact on White House problems with the Israeli lobby.
Yeah, well, obviously, when dealing with a case like this, espionage by Israel, there's going to be pressure from all over the place. Do you know anything about Patrick Fitzgerald and how susceptible to political pressure he might be?
Well, the general word is that he's been kind of grinding ahead on this investigation very, very officiously, and that he is political in the sense that he basically is a Republican. But I don't know exactly to what extent he's susceptible to pressure. That it will be interesting to see how this plays out. But historically, any investigation that's critical of Israel gets squashed. The 9/11, all of the Israeli espionage activities connected with 9/11 were effectively squashed, as you well know.
Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit? You're referring to the Carl Cameron piece from Fox News and stuff?
Well, that's only one bit of it. Justin Raimondo did a very good book on it, as a matter of fact. The Israelis were running widespread unilateral, which was illegal, intelligence operations all up and down, primarily the east coast of the United States. And a number of their teams may or may not have gotten wind of the 9/11 operation coming up and didn't share that information with the United States. It's also very clear that some of these Israeli intelligence units, which were operating up in New Jersey, seemed to know that something was impending, and were actually even staged for photos in Liberty Park across from the burning World Trade Center.
You know, in the book By Way of Deception by Viktor Ostrovsky, a former Mossad agent, he talks in that book about how if the Americans know something that the Israelis need to know, well, they better tell us. But if the Israelis know something that the Americans need to know, they're big boys. They can take care of themselves.
That is the attitude, yes.
Okay, so tell me, what's the word inside the former CIA retired intelligence community? Who forged the Niger documents?
Well, I wouldn't want to name a name, but I would just kind of suggest that it may have been a couple of former CIA officers who were familiar with that part of the world, who were associated with a certain well-known neoconservative who has close connections with Italy. Because the documents surfaced through Italy, and it's clear that that was the channel.
Okay, well, I know who the neoconservative with the links to Italy is. That's Michael Ledeen, the fascist P3 or P4 member or whatever that thing is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's former CIA guys associated with Ledeen.
That's right. And, you know, the as I say, I mean, there are obviously issues in terms of raising someone's name, but the evidence seems to point in the direction of some former agency people who had connections with Ledeen and also had some equity interest, shall we say, with the operation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, a lot of these people are in consulting positions, and they get various, shall we say, emoluments in overseas accounts and that kind of thing.
Another angle on the neocons and the Pentagon and their relations is Ahmed Chalabi. And I know that it's pretty much widespread knowledge, I guess, that Chalabi was being paid by Iran to tip them off, at least when he at least tipped them off to the fact that we had broken the Iranian codes that they were using, and so they changed their codes. But there was, I believe, a Defense Intelligence Agency report that had it that Chalabi actually was working for Iran all along, and his whole role in conning the neocons and telling them that they were going to get this pro-Israeli government and all this, that really he was working for Iran all along.
Well, I think a better way to characterize Chalabi is that Chalabi is working for Chalabi. And Chalabi was playing as positively he could every side of the equation. The neocons were only one element in it. He also had cozy relationships, as you point out, with Iranian intelligence, and this has been corroborated both by DIA and CIA. So Chalabi was on every side of the issue, and Chalabi is now what, the deputy prime minister and petroleum minister of Iraq?
He's the oil minister now. Is he the deputy prime minister too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. So Chalabi has played this better than anyone.
Yep. All right, everybody. We will be right back to wrap up with Philip Giraldi. It's the Intel Report. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome back to the Intel Report. I'm Scott Horton, host of the Weekend Interview Show, filling in for John Statmiller, who's still recuperating from his injuries. I'm talking with Philip Giraldi. He's a former military intelligence officer and CIA counterterrorism official. He writes Deep Background for the American Conservative and is co-publisher of Intelligence Brief with Vincent Canestrano. And so many questions, so little time, but I want to talk about Plan B. Israel's Plan Bs, that's what Seymour Hersh called it, when the Israelis realized that the neocons were completely wrong and that the Iraq war was a total disaster. This was only a couple of months after the invasion, that they decided that they would go for Plan B, which was to basically buy up a bunch of Kurds. And I know you've written a little bit about this. Can you tell me a little bit more about what's going on? There's really not much in the media to go off of.
Yeah, well, it's basically that the Israelis have exploited their relationship with the Pentagon to use the U.S. troops that are in the Kurdish region as cover for their own intelligence activities. They have numerous intelligence officers in the area. Some estimates go as high as possibly 800. The Israeli intelligence officers there are basically in place to keep Iraq broken up and unstable, and also to destabilize neighboring Iran. So that's essentially what they're there for.
Wow. Well, does Bush realize that he's been betrayed? I mean, is this the kind of thing where the Americans don't mind, or what?
Well, again, these things are always more complicated than they seem. The Israelis and this Pentagon, the Rumsfeld Pentagon, basically have had an extremely intimate relationship, and this intimate relationship has meant that U.S. troops train on suppressing civilians by going to Israel and seeing how it's done, and the Israelis in turn are afforded certain privileges within U.S. Intelligence units. You may recall that there was an Israeli presence at Abu Ghraib, which appeared in the press very briefly and then disappeared. Well, the Israelis are basically all over Iraq and are following their own interests.
Well, now these guys training together and that kind of thing, I understand that, but when you're talking about Israel wants to keep Kurdistan basically as sovereign as they can while the Bush administration is trying as best they can to create a strong central government, or at least one strong enough to hold the country together. Are these not cross purposes?
Well, they are precisely cross purposes, but the problem is the cross purposes are not verbalized. They don't come to the surface in any way that the president would even be aware that there's an issue.
Right. Maybe Cheney does, but Bush surely doesn't.
That's right. Cheney may know what's going on. Rumsfeld almost certainly knows what's going on. But, you know, they see it as a quid pro quo, where there's a trade-off in terms of what they believe they're getting from the Israelis in return for what they're allowing the Israelis to do.
Now, Julian Borger wrote an article in The Guardian called The Spies Who Pushed for War. And in there he says that basically the Israelis had the same situation in the run-up to the Iraq war that the Americans had, and that was that the Mossad wasn't lying well enough. And we all know that Cheney made, I think, 14 trips to CIA headquarters before he finally gave up and created the OSP to lie us into war here. But according to Borger in The Guardian, Ariel Sharon had the same problem with Mossad and created OSP of his own over there. Can you confirm that?
Yeah, I've heard that same story, and also I have seen the report in The Guardian. I believe it, because essentially a lot of intelligence people actually have some integrity before they bury it at a certain point when they become careerists. And there is always dissent in the intelligence agencies for policies that are just nonsense.
Right. All right. I want to thank you very much for your time this hour, sir.
Thank you.
Everybody, Philip Giraldi. And you can read him in the American Conservative magazine. And we'll be right back.